All right, we ready to get started? Now, let's remind you what we were doing before the long weekend. We are finishing up chapter 4. Practically done, but I want to go through and remind you a little bit because quiz tomorrow covers chapter 4 and 5, and some of these techniques are common. Okay. We have two types of problems. Generally, we have non-equilibrium problems and equilibrium problems. In a non-equilibrium problem, the acceleration is not zero. In an equilibrium problem, there's no acceleration. Okay? You can either have a body that's not moving, or you can have a body that's moving with a constant velocity. Okay, in which case, the net force is zero. As I indicated, most problems, we're looking at static equilibrium, in which case the body is not moving, it stays at rest because the net force acting on it is zero. There are various forces. Tension. And if you have cables, ropes, things like that involved, you possibly have tension, which I use machines for. We have a weight, right, which we've been using W's. We can compute the weight of an object, which is M times little g. Little g near the surface of the Earth, we're taking is 9.8 meters per second squared. Okay. And then there's the normal force, which I've been designating as N. The book designates with an F sub N with a subscript. Okay. The normal force is a force that is applied by a surface. You put an object on a surface, okay, according to Newton's third law, the surface is pushing back on the object. And finally, there's friction. There are two types of friction, kinetic and static friction. Both types, Fk and Fs, are proportional to the normal force, depending upon whether I want to put an S here or a K here, okay, as far as the types of friction that we have. And so static or kinetic friction, this is, again, mu, lowercase Greek m. That's the coefficient of static or kinetic friction, which we can designate with a mu s or a mu k. And those things you typically look up or are given. Okay. There's no standard mu that you need to memorize or anything like that. Right. All right. So the last thing we did was talk about inclined planes. And then we did a lab in which we put an object on an incline and used the fact that the acceleration is minus g sine theta. So this is a case where the surface is frictionless. The body will slide down with no opposition to that motion. So the object slides down the incline, and there is an acceleration. And we wanted to find the acceleration. What you have are two forces. You have the weight and the normal force. If we add these up as vectors, take the normal force, slide it down, you end up with an overall vector pointing downward, which means that there's a net force acting on the object. Making use of components. Again, the sum of the forces is equal to ma. Which law is this? Second law. All right, so making use of the second law in component form. The x direction, remember we put the x axis parallel to the incline, and the y-axis is perpendicular to that. So looking at these components, we have that the only x component turned out to be this component of the weight, which is right there. That's opposite the angle, so I have sine of theta, which came in this part. Mg is the magnitude of the weight, and negative because it's leaning toward the negative direction on the x-axis. That's the net force acting on the body. It's equal to mass times acceleration. And we designate up as positive acceleration and down as negative acceleration. Then the y components. If we look at the y components, I can complete this triangle. There's the y component that magnitude of the weight, so that's minus mg cosine theta. Again, that's pointing negative, in this case, along the y-axis. And the normal force is positive. Those are the total forces acting in that direction. No acceleration in the vertical direction. Otherwise, this thing would be moving upward or downward at some point, in which case it's either jumping off the incliner or bearing itself into it. So the net force is m times zero. No acceleration. We can solve for the normal force. We can solve that for the acceleration. So there is a component of the weight which is being supported by this platform, right? So the normal force is not the whole weight. It's just part of it. Again, the normal force does not equal mg all the time. You have to look at it in different situations. In this case, n is mg cosine theta.
How much could we just memorize these formulas? Would you recommend that whenever we see this problem, like go straight?
No, I wouldn't recommend it because this is fairly quick to write down. You just have to realize where this angle is, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you just have to look at your right triangles and about that. No, I would not memorize this. The only thing you need to know here is Newton's law of motion, second law, right? And what else would you have to know in this case? Well, you have to know the weight is mg. So those two pieces, and knowing how to break up vectors, and you can get yourself out of that. All right, what if I have friction? Okay, what I indicated the other day was we have an incline such as this. And if I raise this up, that object is not accelerating, is it? If I raise it high enough, it will, until the spring gets in the way. Okay, now it's going to accelerate. Of course, there's friction involved in either case. What I would like to know is, at what angle is this going to just begin to slide? Okay, so that's somewhere around right there. Neighborhood of 20 degrees. So if I put this here, it's not sliding, but if I raise it a little bit more, okay, a little bit, okay, it just begins to slide. Actually, it's a little higher than that. So this is about 22 degrees. Of course, there's a, the surface here varies a little bit, so now that I put this on there, that doesn't slide up here, it does here. So there's a little variability in the experiment. Okay, so when does this object just begin to slide down? When there's friction involved. We have the same problem. All right, we have an angle, and we'd like to know at what point this object just begins to slide down the incline. Okay, again, a normal force, we have the weight, and in the previous case, when no friction was there, this would accelerate. Why is this not accelerating? There's a frictional force. Which way is the frictional force pointing? Up the incline. Okay? There's a net force going down, right? The net force going down is actually going to be, minus mg sine theta. But there's a balancing force going up, so that instead of an ma here, I want zero, I would have to add another force to the other side. So there is a frictional force going in the positive x direction, remembering our axes in the previous diagram. What kind of frictional force is holding this object up?
Static.
And at that point at which this just gets ready to slide, if I go up a little bit more, I've overcome the static friction. So we're really looking at the maximum value of the static friction. Right? That can hold that. If I have it at a lower angle, there's still static friction holding it. It's just not as big as the maximum value. And the maximum value, as we know, is given by something proportional to the normal force. Okay, so that's my situation. The sum of the forces is equal to zero. So I have the weight plus the normal force plus the static frictional force all add up to zero, which is different from this case. And what do? We take the statement of Newton's second law. In this case, it's an equilibrium problem. And we break it up into components and get what? Well, the weight and the normal force have the same components in this picture as they did back here. The only differences are there's no acceleration, but there's friction. So over in my previous problem, all I have to do is get rid of the acceleration term and add in the friction term. So it's relatively simple. Fs is going up. Minus mg sine theta, that's the component of the weight, which we computed the other day. I'm just looking at what we did already. This gives me zero acceleration. The y component. How is the y component equation affected by putting the friction in? Correct response is it's not. All right? Friction is horizontal. The only y components here, again, are the y component of the weight and the y component of the normal force. So we get the same equation that we had before. Okay? So I'm just looking at what we did back here and asking how is that modified by throwing in this frictional part. Okay? So there's the physics. There's one other thing I need to note, is that the static friction here is the maximum value that I need to put in there. So let's rewrite those. So my x component, I can put in ms times the normal force minus mg sine theta equals zero. All right? But what do we know about the normal force? Well, the normal force, we can just solve this for the normal force like we did before. The normal force is mg cosine theta. So this, say what?
I mean, how are you getting the normal force minus mg sine theta?
What's the definition of frictional force? Frictional force is proportional to the normal, so I just replaced Fs. All right? Take this equation and replace this by mu times the normal force. That's the only thing I did here. That's the frictional force by definition. Okay? So what do? Replace it. Now we can replace n. Solve this for n. N is mg cosine theta, so let's see. That's going to be mu sub s mg cosine theta minus mg sine theta equals zero. Okay, so two steps. I put in the definition of f sub s, and I went and put in the value of the normal force, which you can solve for the y component in this problem. And then we stand back and look at that, and let's see. Notice that both terms have an m, so I can divide through by m. We will eliminate that. Anything else I can do? Divide through by g. Let's see, what does that leave me? U sub s cosine theta minus sine theta is zero. And I can solve this for mu sub s. what do I get? U sub s is equal to sine, bring the sine over, I get sine over the cosine, or mu sub s, as some people recognize already, is the tangent, right? Sine over cosine simplifies the tangent to an identity. Okay, so what does this tell me? This tells me that I can determine my coefficient of static friction by doing this experiment. I just keep doing it over and over again because you notice it changed a little bit. Take the average of a bunch of values, and I can get an experimental determination of what mu sub s is for my box with the felt going down that metal. Of course, I could go and pull out another one of these inclines that has glass on it, and I would expect my mu to be different, possibly. Right? Different surfaces, or I could put a different object. Okay, like one of these pieces of metal on here, right? That's not going anywhere, so that mu is going to be a lot different. So, if I'm careful and do the experiment, I can determine mu sub s by just determining this angle. This angle at which an object just begins to slide is called the angle of repose. Now, there are other experiments we could do. We can ask, at what angle do I have to have an object going down at a constant velocity? And so one can do experiments where you can put an object, give it a little kick, and you don't want it to accelerate. So you adjust this and do that experiment, in which case it's the same physics here, except I would then not be using the static coefficient of friction, but I'd be using the kinetic coefficient of friction. All right, and if we're very careful of doing this, we could possibly find out that mu s and mu k are different. Okay, so we could also do that if I had this object moving at a constant velocity, because that means it's still zero acceleration. It's just not static equilibrium. Yes, sir.
Is there any way that you could tell if the static friction is the max, if it's the maximum value of the object?
Well, in this case, the maximum is the value that gets this moving.
Yeah, but
see, if I have this sitting down here, okay, I can't very well do too much. Well, let's see. I can't actually substitute mu s n in here. I can only do that for the maximum value. So I can say that that object now is sitting there. I can get fs. That's going to be mg sine theta. That's all I can say about that frictional force. But I cannot put that equal to mu n because that's not the maximum value.
So we're always solving for just the mass in
right.
this problem.
Exactly. Okay. Well, we can dream up several more of these kinds of problems, but it's time to introduce another force, okay, or the other types of problems. Let's see. I might as well start. Again, in all these problems, take and draw free body diagrams for each mass, and then write down the equations. Okay? And in the case where the forces are not all in the same direction, like this part, then you're going to have to break it into x and y components. Okay. All right, chapter 5. We introduce what's called uniform circular motion. Okay. So this is another type of problem with several more applications, of course. All right, uniform circular motion. What does circular motion mean? Motion in a circle. Okay, so we have things going around in circles. There's a circle. We usually classify circles as having a radius. So let R be the radius. Imagine having an object going around a circle of radius R. That's the basic idea. For circular motion, what could uniform possibly mean? Uniform means it's moving around at a constant speed. So, motion in a circle at constant speed. That's what uniform circular motion is. So at the racetrack on Sunday you were circular, you're okay, and you were going around there, right? That's the Indianapolis 500, right? Going around in a circle, first off you'd have to maintain a radius. Fixed radius for the circle, and secondly, what you would read on your speedometer would be the same at all times. Okay? So that's the idea for that. Motion at a constant speed. So let's designate G to be the speed. Speed is just the magnitude of the velocity in this case. Okay, so V is the speed. And let's see what kinds of things can I say. All right, how much time would it take to go around once?
Pi r squared.
Time to make one revolution. How could I figure out how much time it would take? If I were going around at speed V and I knew what the radius were, could I figure out how much time it would take? Eventually. Okay, well, what do we know about the relationship between speed and time and something else?
Acceleration.
What is speed?
Acceleration of
time.
Speed is distance over time.
Is distance. Per time, right? That's going way back. Actually, we didn't mention it in chapter one. What's the distance we've gone in one revolution?
Pi r squared.
Let's see, pi r squared. Let's see, that would be meters times meters of meters squared. Is that a distance? It's the circumference. Alright, the distance I've gone completely around the circle is the circumference. What is the formula for the circumference in terms of the radius? 2 pi r. That's the distance you've gone around. Okay? And per time. Let's call the time that it takes to make one revolution capital T. This has another name. It's called the period. Come up several times. So the time to make one revolution is called a period. So I'm going to put a capital T down here. So 2 pi r over t is the speed. Of course, what's the speed? The speed is v. So this implies that the speed is 2 pi r over period. Do I need to memorize this? Someone might ask. You shouldn't have to. You should know what the circumference is. We already know the distance over the time. We should be able to derive this. Right? This should not be. There's a lot of equations that you think you have to memorize, but you don't if you think about them. Okay. This is distance over time. Right? That's the speed. Okay. All right, so now we know something about motion in a circle at constant speed. We can figure out what the speed is if I know the radius and how long it takes to go around. Those are typical things. Or I could estimate how long it's going to take if I could look at my speedometer and I try to maintain that speed. Right? And I could figure out capital T. So there's all kinds of things. Or I could just go around in a circle. I don't know what the radius is, but things I can do is look at my speedometer, look at my watch, and from that determine the radius of the track, or at least the path that I'm taking. Okay. What about the velocity? Is the velocity constant?
Yes, it is.
So, the uniform circular motion, is the velocity constant? Got a lot of people saying yes, shaking their heads yes, and the answer is no. Okay. Let's see if I can convince you. Okay. Well, let me just go to my picture. Okay, which way would the velocity be pointing if this were going in a counterclockwise direction? So let's say the mass is going around this way.
Straight up.
Which way is the velocity pointing?
Straight up.
Tangent to the circle. In this case, up. At that particular instant of time. Everybody agree?
Yeah.
All right, so this is a path. It's just like our projectile motion path, right? The velocity vector is tangent to the path. What if it were sitting here? Which way is the velocity vector pointing? Tangent to the path, which is which direction there?
To the left.
Horizontal to the left. Are those vectors the same?
No.
No, why?
Because one's negative and one's...
One's pointing up, one's pointing to the left, right? They're different directions. Remember, a vector has magnitude and direction. What is the magnitude of this vector? The velocity. What's the magnitude of the velocity? What did I say a few minutes ago?
Speed.
So the magnitude corresponds to the length of the vector, right? So what would the magnitude be up here? The same. So each of these vectors should hopefully be the same. I didn't measure it when I drew it, but it looked about the same. So no matter where I look on this path, if I look at my velocity vector, the direction is changing, but the magnitude is the same. So the vector is always tangent to the path, but the length of the vector is constant because the speed is constant. However, the velocity is changing. Okay, so the velocity is not constant. Everybody? So the velocity is not constant, which means what? There must be an acceleration. Right? Velocity is not constant, which implies the acceleration is not zero. Right? What is the average acceleration? The change in velocity per change in time. If the velocity is not constant, then the change in velocity is not zero, therefore there is an acceleration. Right? Of course, delta t is not zero, so. Alright? So there's a non-zero acceleration. If there's an acceleration, what does that mean? What have we learned from chapter 4? It's accelerating, what must be happening? There must be a net force acting on the body. So this implies that the net force acting on that particular body is not zero. Okay. What we would like to do is investigate situations where something is undergoing uniform circular motion, and we are going to make use of the idea that the net force is not zero. Of course, in order for me to do that, the net force is equal to ma. I have to determine what a is. Need to know the acceleration for circular motion. We haven't determined that yet. We've only determined the speed. Okay. need the acceleration before we continue. So let's see. This acceleration is called centripetal. Centripetal acceleration. Centripetal means center seeking. Let's see. So let's get some sense as to what the acceleration might look like. There's a part of my circle. Just take an arc, which indicates that perhaps we can experience centripetal acceleration if I just go up and around a curve. We don't have to go full circle. All we have to do is go around the bend. Okay? And there is centripetal acceleration. So we're interested right now in uniform circular motion, so we're going to continue to move in circles. So there's a radius, here's my mass. So at some instant, my mass is moving with some velocity. At a later instance, the mass is up here. It is moving, again, we have a velocity that has the same length, but different direction, tangent to the circle. Let's say that at t equals 0, my initial observation of velocity is v0. At a later time t, my velocity is given by v. So there are my two velocity vectors. And if I want to compute the acceleration, of course, I have to compute the change in velocity, don't I? So what is the change in velocity? Final minus the initial velocity. Now looking at these as vectors, okay, I can find the difference in these two velocities by simply moving this velocity vector down, connecting them. So I can think of, carefully sliding this down. My velocity vector b, and the difference in two velocities, as I indicated one other time, all right, if I want to take the difference of two vectors, it turns out to be the vector that completes the triangle pointing from the first one, the initial one, to the final one, pointing from here to there. So delta b is that vector. Another way to look at this is if I bring the v0 to the other side, v is v0 plus the change. All right, I believe we did this back in chapter 3 when we talked about displacement and talked about the difference between vectors. So v, if delta v is v minus v0, then v should be v0 plus, right? There's v0. What do we do when we add vectors? Connect head to tail. So that gives me the correct direction. So v plus v0 is v. All right. The important thing is that delta v points in the direction of that pink arrow. Points in this direction. What's the acceleration? Divide this by delta t. So if I divide by delta t, well, that's the same thing as multiplying by some real number. It does not change the direction. T is positive. So again, the acceleration is pointing in that direction. It's just going to be a different size than this arrow. And if I go all the way around my path, I find out that the acceleration, okay, will typically be pointing to the center of this problem. So So going back to my other picture here, what we have here is we have the velocity vectors in yellow, and at each point, the instantaneous acceleration, one can show, is pointing to the center. So that's the direction. Sometimes this is called radial acceleration. So this is radial means it's pointing along a radius. And we all know radii go through the center of circles. If I wanted to compute the acceleration, all I have to do is compute delta v over delta t. Then one can do this with some geometric arguments. I am not going to go through the geometric argument. I'm sure you'll get much out of it. There's some assumptions there that you might not believe. But the textbook essentially does that by saying, oh, well, I've got a triangle and the big circle connecting these objects, and I have this little triangle that's these two yellow vectors plus that pink one. And these are similar triangles, and one can, through playing with the ratios of the sides of the triangle, determine what the acceleration in the problem is. Basically, determine delta v over delta t. Okay, but I'm not going to go through that. I'm just going to state that this gives me the direction. So we have a radial direction. And the most important thing is, what is the magnitude of the acceleration? So one can derive geometrically what this magnitude is. And the magnitude of the acceleration for uniform circular motion, well, it should involve just two things, right? It should involve the velocity and the radius. And if you do some dimensional analysis, it's possible to actually figure out, okay, how you can get a radius and a velocity to work together to give you an acceleration. And in this case, it turns out to be v squared over r. I'm going to put a little sub c there for centripetal. Okay? So we're going to skip over the derivation, though those of you who are interested can read what the text does, okay? So that you can convince yourselves that maybe this is possible. Okay? But we're going to take this as fact now. This one you probably have to memorize, because it's not as obvious, right? Okay. Answer Aaron's question. All right. Let's see. Does this make sense? If I go around a fixed circle faster, am I going to feel more forces on me? Or is it going to need more force to keep this on the road? For a car going around the track. Yeah, you're going to need more force to keep you on the road. If you go around too fast, you're just going to slide off the road. Okay, and we'll verify that in a few minutes. If I make a smaller radius track, but go at the same speed on both tracks, or in other words, let's say you try to go around a much sharper turn. All right, a sharper turn would correspond to a smaller radius. All right, you would feel the same. It's harder to stay on. You need the net force acting on your car be great enough to keep you on that circle. Okay. So those are the types of things that we're going to look at. This is the acceleration for going around a circle at v constant radius r. Okay. Now what we'd like to do is make use of some of this in some problems. And before we do that, let's take a break. A mass that for some reason is maintaining a constant speed around a circle of constant radius. Okay, this body is accelerating. I've indicated that. The acceleration is pointing in a radial direction toward the center of the circle. So we see from the little pink arrows here, it's pointing toward the center of the circle. The magnitude of the acceleration is given by v squared over r. It takes a force, or a net force, to give me that acceleration. So for centripetal force problems, we are going to look at the net force acting on the body that could possibly lead to the acceleration. Well, Newton's second law tells me the net force is ma, right? In our case, there's only one acceleration here, and that's the centripetal acceleration. So the net forces must add up to the mass times the centripetal acceleration. Which way must the net force be pointing? Toward the center of the circle. So we really have to see what forces are responsible for the uniform circular motion leading to this. This net force, okay, is often referred to as the centripetal force because that's the total force that's leading to this centripetal acceleration. Okay. So we're going to look at a couple of examples. The first example would be something like this ball on a string. Okay, I spin this around like that. Okay, what is causing that thing to go around, hopefully at a constant speed, but at least going around at a constant radius? What?
The strings.
What's keeping that so that it goes in circular motion?
The strings.
The tension in the string. Of course, my hand is providing that tension, right? I'm pulling on the string, and with some force to hold it, right, I keep pulling it inward. If I let go, what happened if I let go of this? Let's say when it got up to this point, as it's going around, it'll just, right? Once no net force is acting on it, it's going to continue to travel on a straight line. Of course, we know there is a force downward, okay? That's why this problem is a little different, okay? Because when it's going up, when it's at the top, there's two forces pulling down on it, gravity plus the tension. When it's at the bottom, gravity's pulling, but the tension's pulling up, right? Those types of forces you would have to be a little bit more careful working with, and you'll see some of that in the homework. Those are the types of forces that you see when these people are doing the loop-the-loops, okay? The force at the top is definitely different than the force at the bottom because you've got gravity working as well. Okay, but we're going to look at a very simple problem. Even though, as by now you've recognized that all blackboards are vertical, does not mean that my motion is vertical, right? So consider this is the string as I'm twirling it around, all right? That object is going around and around. Here's the center. What is the force acting on this? The tension. Only if there's a string. We'll find out. Let's see if I can answer that. Okay? She wanted to know if there's always tension in these problems. Okay? There isn't that one because I had a string, right? So it's the string that's keeping this going around. Let's ask what the tension is on that. Okay? So as this is twirling around, I don't know. Make up some numbers. Okay. So as I spin this around, okay, what kinds of things do I have? How fast is around? How much time is that taking to go around? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. It's going pretty fast, right? So about how fast do you think we might want to say this is moving? Roughly.
1 T.
Okay, so it goes around like that. That's got to be at least a half a meter, right? It's doing it in a fraction of a second, half a second, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe.
Say what? You only got 2 meters a second? Is that what you said? I don't know. I'm making up some numbers, but hopefully somewhat realistic. What is the radius? Well, that radius was, I don't know, about yay. Let's say 30, well, let's see. This is 30 centimeters. That's probably about right. Let's say the radius is 30 centimeters. And then, of course, we need to know what the mass of this is. All right. Aaron, how much is that?
I'll do it here.
Huh? probably heavier than that, though. See, 25, 3, that's about, that would have to be about 8 pennies worth. Okay, but that's good enough. Question is, what's the tension in this problem? Okay, the key to doing any of these is that the net force is the mass times the centripetal acceleration. What is the net force acting on this in this direction? It's the tension. All right?
Yeah.
Oh, in this case, it's the tension. One of the problems that we're going to begin to face here. Normally, I don't have the same letter on the board at the same time. Okay, I have to take it in the context. So the tension. Is equal to the mass times the acceleration. What's the acceleration? V squared over R. So the total force, which is just the tension, is just going to be mv squared over r. We can go through and compute this. What is my mass? 25 grams. What do I need to do if I want tension at newtons? You need to convert things. 25 grams is how many kilograms?
0.025.
Divide 25 by 1,000 kilograms. Velocity. 2 meters per second, that's good, so that's just 2 squared. Divided by 30. Radius, 30 centimeters is how many meters?
0.3.
So mv squared over r, you can now compute that. That's 4 times 0.025 is what, 0.1, it's like 1/3. Here we go.
0.3.
Yeah, 0.3. About 0.3 or 0.33. And okay. Well, I think that mass is a little heavier than that. It felt like more than 0.3 mass to me. But the idea here is it's pretty obvious, as was already pointed out, that I've got this string in there as I'm twirling it around. Okay, let's look at some other problems. Okay, I talked about cars going around tracks. So let's look at what's known as an unbanked track. Okay. So for an unbanked track, the idea is the following. I have a circular track. We're going to put a car on this track. And that car is moving counterclockwise around the track. There's the car going around the track. Here's the center of the track. It's moving around at a constant speed, constant radius, and the question is, what force is responsible for it staying on the track? The net force has to be the mass times the acceleration, right? This definitely is accelerating. Is there a string? No. No strings attached. Now, this could be a model airplane. You could have a string, right? I mean, there's all sorts of, right? But in this case, there is no string to hold this from flying off. What's holding it? Well, gravity is pointing. Remember, this is a track in which this car is going like that, right? Gravity's up and down. It has nothing to do with the horizontal.
A centripetal
friction. Friction will hold the car on the track. Okay? There must be friction. It must be pointing to the center. That direction to hold it there. Okay, so there's the friction that's holding this on the track. If I wanted, I could look at my track, okay, by watching the back of the car. So here's the car going around, right? I could take this, turn it flat, look in this direction, and I would have my car sitting here. So the car is going into the board at this point. Right, I've turned it around. Friction is pointing in which direction? Well, it's basically the same direction that I've gone there, right? So we have friction going in that direction. There's a net force in this direction, okay, which is responsible for keeping the car on the road. All right. What other forces are acting on this car?
Its weight.
Its weight. All right, does any weight. What else? There's a normal force. Okay, so this is a picture of my car with the forces acting on it. Again, the net force is zero, right? These two are going to cancel each other. There's only going to be a force in this direction. But remember, in this picture now, we've got the center there. The car is going around like that. Okay, those are my forces. So the net force must be equal to the mass times the centrifugal acceleration. Let me write this out. Let's see, in component form. So my x components essentially are that we have the frictional force. And if I were to adopt, in this case, left is negative and that's positive like we did before, so we don't get confused. I would actually put a minus there. There are no x components for the normal or the weight. This must be equal to the mass times the centripetal acceleration. The centripetal acceleration has a magnitude of v squared over r. Which way is the acceleration pointing on this car? Is it pointing to the left? To the right or to the left? To the left, right? See, it's center seeking. So this is also negative. Okay. Let me write down the y component, and then I have something else I have to point out. Y components, what do we have? We have normal pointing up, mg pointing down, just in case we forgot over the long break, right? And up, mg down. They're the only vertical components. We could have easily written down by now n is equal to mg. If not, just write down the y components. These must be zero because I'm not expecting the car to be leaving the road. Okay? Or we're hoping there's no potholes for them. That would change the problem. All right, these are the x and the y components. There's one little detail I've left out of this. What kind of friction is this?
Kinetic.
Static.
Kinetic.
Okay, we've got one static and everybody else kinetic. Huh? Is the car sliding this way or that way? No. It's static. It's only going forward. Right? Kinetic friction is important in this direction, but it's not important that way, right? This car is not sliding to the left and to the right. So this is actually static coefficient of friction. Even though the car is moving, it's moving forward, right? Of course, that friction you need for the wheels to go around, but it could slide, right? It's not sliding. Well, we hope it's not sliding yet. So this is actually something you need to think about. Okay. Why is it? It's moving. Why isn't it kinetic? All right. This is static. What do we know? Let's see. Of course, the car will stay on the road until that force is great enough to overcome the maximum value of the static friction, right? So what is F, the maximum value We've seen this before. It's mu sub s times the normal force. So I could ask, all right, I've got this car going around my racetrack. It's going around faster and faster and faster. What's the fastest I can go around this track without slipping? Okay. Well, the fastest I can go is when this frictional force is equal to that value. So, as we did before, I will now take Fs and I will plug in Usn. Minus signs I'm going to drop. You won't be upset, right? I can use the eraser method here. So, clear that we don't have to put that in. What is Fs? This is Usn equals M V squared over R. What's N?
Mg negative.
Y component. Solve that for N. In this case, N is Mg. So let's put that in. Us Mg is equal to M V squared over R. And what am I left with? C. I can cancel out the M's, right? And I can solve this for the fastest that I can travel. Okay, under these conditions, v squared is equal to, bring an r up, and I have a mu s, so I have a g already at this on the left, bring the r over, and there I can solve this for v, just take the square root. And we've derived a relationship here that says the fastest I can go before my car begins to slip, before I overcome that maximum static friction, is mu sub s. What's that depend upon? What depends upon, you know, if the track is dry, what the traction is between the tires and the road, right? G depends if I'm on Earth, right? Instead of a Land Rover on the moon or something. Okay, R depends on the radius of track. So I know how what the radius of track is. I know what G is. Mu S, you know, I have to know something about the road and my tires and how they react. But we could go ahead and plug in some numbers and see what the maximum speed is. So let's do that. Put a couple numbers in. So V is equal to the square root of USGR. I don't know. Let's say US is, say, 0.5. Question is, has that reasonable or not? If we could look up values.
Let's see. Take US to be 0.5. What are the units?
There isn't one.
No units. Good. And give me a track radius.
500 meters.
500 meters. Is that a big track?
It's not really. Yeah, like half a mile.
Well, that's a good number. All right. We'll find out how fast we can drive on this track. Okay. So you might want to go home today and say, I wonder how big these tracks really are. The track that comes upon our legs. All right, let's plug this in. This is the square root of 0.5, which is actually a half, right, times 9.8 times 500. It's about 250 times that 25. I don't know where we get to about 50. 49.5, which is about 50. 50 what? Meters per second. So the maximum I can drive on that track is 50 meters per second, which is probably over 100 miles an hour. Well, either my mu sub s is not big enough for reality, or my tracks are not big enough. But they can go that fast, but they can go faster, right? So it might not be a good track if you want to be going 200 or 300 miles an hour, or 50, whatever. Okay. But then we find out it rained. All right. What happens to my problem if it had rained?
The friction.
Right. US changes. Does it go up or down? Down. So if you go down to say 0.2, which means then you would get a different value. So what if US is 0.2? Of course, we could go even further down by drawing oil on the track, right? All right, what would this one correspond to? Put a 0.2 instead of a 0.5 in there, what do you get? What do you get? 31.3. At about 31 meters per second. Anybody agree with that? That look right? All right, so it goes down. Okay? Of course, it could go down further and further. But my other example was oil on the track. Would you expect there to be any oil on the track? Not everywhere, but some places, right? We can't count on these different conditions, right? Affecting things. So we need to do something to at least be safer and not have to rely so much on, you know, oil dripping out of engines or cars exploding on the track and we have to drive around, whatever. Okay? So how do we make up for this? Well, instead of having an unbanked track, we're going to have to provide a banked track, in which case we can derive the conditions for our. What happens if I don't want to pay attention to friction right now? Okay, we have a bank track. So instead of a track in which you're going around like this, which is flat everywhere, you're going to bank it. You're going to put it at an angle, have the car at an angle, and that track goes off at some angle. Okay, pointing away from the center. Okay, so here's my bank track. I'm going to take the same car and put it on a bank track, right? So here's my car. The center, again, I'll have the same point of view. My car is going around. Okay, I'm looking at the back of it while it's on the right side of the center. Now I need a car that's banked here. Into the board, going around, okay. And right now what I want to do is ask, what happens if I ignore the friction for the time being? Let's not think about friction. And ask, what's keeping this car on the track if I'm not going to factor in friction? I mean, the worst that can happen is having a frictionless track, right? So this is a pretty good. I can get this car to stay on the track if I don't have at least any friction of, you know, this guy wants to slide up or down. Okay, so what forces are acting on my car?
Weight. Normal.
A normal force.
Friction.
But I said let's.
Oh, wait, no friction.
Ignore friction, which are the worst case scenario.
Is there acceleration?
Well, is there acceleration? Is this car accelerating as it's going around the track?
Thomas.
Yes, that's the whole point of this section. All right, there's a net force acting on the body, and this net force is going to keep the body on the track. So I'm going to have some acceleration. Let's see, as this track car is going around, all right, the acceleration is pointing toward the center. So we have an acceleration, okay, that's keeping this there. And we need to determine, again, things like, you know, what's the relationship between the safe speed and the radius, sprint speed and the radius.
So is that going to be A sub C?
Well, that's the only acceleration we have.
Okay,
yes.
Well, in case.
Exactly. So this is going to be centripetal acceleration. All right, so I want to look at the forces in the problem. Before, when we looked at inclines, we had x going up and down the plane and y going in that direction. The reason for that was we had fewer vectors that were not vertical or horizontal in that system. In this case, we have w is up and down, a is that direction, n is off at an angle. If I were to put x this way, then a would also have two components. I don't want to do that, so we're going to go back and let x be horizontal and y be vertical. So before I do anything, I'm going to indicate x and y are in the usual orientation. Do we see any component that's horizontal? Anything have a horizontal component that's not a zero?
Acceleration.
The acceleration, which we hope, yes. And the normal force. Notice that the normal force will have a component in the same direction as a. That is going to lead us to our net force in that direction, giving me my centripetal acceleration. All right, we need to break everything down into components. So let's look at the x component. In the x components, let's see, we've already determined that the normal force has an x component. The way I've drawn this, it's probably not hard to see that the angle upstairs is the same as the angle of the incline. Okay. So let's see, that's opposite, which means what? The x component is going to be n times sine. Is that positive or negative?
Negative.
And have a positive or negative x component. In
negative.
Negative. Negative. X component of the weight?
Zero.
So the net force in the x direction is just given by minus n sine theta, and the mass times the acceleration. Is there an acceleration in the x direction?
Yes.
Yeah. It's pointing to the left, so it's negative mass times the centripetal acceleration. That's the only acceleration, right? We're keeping this thing on the track. Okay, constant speed, constant radius, so we have v squared over r. So the net force in the x direction is essentially mv squared over r. The y components. Notice that if I'm interested in doing anything here, I know it needs to do something with my n, like get rid of it. What's the y component? Let's see, is there a y component for n?
Yes.
Yes, what is it?
N.
So height of that right triangle, which is going to be n.
N cosine theta.
Cosine theta, because theta is next to that vertical side. Is it positive or negative?
Positive.
Positive up, upwards, so it's positive. W?
Minus W.
Minus mg. Is there any acceleration in the vertical direction?
No. We hope
no. Okay, all the physics is there. Okay. We can find a relationship between the different variables if I eliminate n from both equations. So we can eliminate n, By taking the second equation and solving for n and plugging it into the first. So solve the second for n. Bring m g over. Divide by the cosine, so n is mg over the cosine of the angle. Okay. So I've solved the second and substitute into the first equation. So now I know from the second equation an expression for n. I can replace the n up here. And I can get rid of the minus signs as well. Hopefully nobody will be upset if I do that. So what do I get? Mg over cosine theta times the sine of theta is equal to mb squared over r. Okay? Everybody happy with that? Alright, this is n. You plug it into the first part. Multiply it by sine. Sine over cosine is
tangent.
So we see a tangent coming out. What else do we notice?
Get rid of the m's.
We can cancel out the m's because there's an m on both sides. And we end up with, let's see, tangent theta times g. I'm going to bring the g to the other side if you don't mind. So I have a b squared over. So, divide by g. What's this here? Tangent theta is what's left. And there's a relationship between the angle at which I need to bank this and the speed that I would like to design the track for, the radius of the track. So if I want to design this track for some safe speed v, all right, then I can determine the angle, okay, at which to do this. Okay. All right, so that's enough on tracks, right? We have unbanked tracks, banked tracks, we have tensions. Right here we had a string. It was easy to see what was making that object stay in circular motion. Here, what kept the object in circular motion? It was the friction. What kept it over here? Well, not the acceleration, because that's what is the result, right? What we have to be asking is, what is the net force responsible for keeping this thing from flying off? In this case, it was a component of the normal force. All right, it was a horizontal component of the normal force. So let me do one more example. Circular motion. Because again, this is only an approximate approximation. But in this case, we want to consider satellite motion. Assume our satellites move around in circles, though Kepler has shown that some of our satellites don't have to be in circles, they can be in ellipses. But the elliptical path of the Earth's orbit is fairly circular. It's just a little bit off from being a circle. So satellite motion means you basically have some body at the center around which a satellite travels. So we have a little mass out here traveling around a bigger mass, and let's assume that it travels in a circle. This could be the moon going around the Earth. This could be one of the planets going around the sun. Okay, and those are the types of examples you would see here. Okay, or this could be a man-made satellite, right? Let's put out there like our GPS satellites or whatever. Weather satellites, spy satellites. Okay. So we have a satellite going around in circular motion. Let's assume it's going around at a constant speed. At a fixed radius. Is it accelerating?
Yes.
Yes, hopefully we've learned that much, right? The acceleration is the centripetal acceleration is v squared over r. Now, what do you think I'm going to ask?
How fast is it going?
Yeah, what's responsible for this acceleration? What's keeping it in circular?
Gravity.
It's not a rope.
Gravity.
Gravity. Very good. There's a gravitational force. The net force between these bodies is gravity, right? We have a gravitational force pulling. So that gravitational force is responsible for keeping that satellite in circular motion around the Earth, or whatever the center body is. Okay? So if I were to look at the net forces equal to the mass times the centripetal acceleration, but again, we're going to look along the radial direction. What we learned today, little m corresponds to the mass of the little mass. What we learned today is that this is mv squared over r. Tomorrow, you're actually going to do this in lab and verify the little force equation. Gravity. What is the equation that I have to put in for gravity? Well, go to Newton. This is g times the product of the masses divided by the square of the distance between them. That was from the last chapter, right? So now, there's my gravitational force at between the two of these objects. Gravity is the big, right? The big one's pulling on the little one, keeping it centered. Let's see, what is it? The m's go out. Again, the m's go out. And just like in the last problem, right, the m's went out, which meant it doesn't matter what the mass of my car is that I'm driving. Over here, the m's go out. It doesn't matter if it's the moon going at this distance or a man-made satellite going at this distance or somebody's Tang bottle that got thrown out of a spaceship. Okay. In order for it to maintain the circular orbit, it's got to be going that fast. If it's not going that fast, if it's going too slow, gravity's going to pull it in, right? So there's, you know, you've got to be going fast enough so you don't get sucked in. If you're going faster than that, then you fly away. So there's a nice speed here. And we can figure out what that speed is, that we would need to put a satellite up so that we could keep it in circular orbit. Okay, let's see. So m's go out. I can solve this for what?
Can you take one r out?
I can take an r out, multiply both sides by r. I'm left with gm over r is equal to v squared. And now you can take the square root of both sides. R is the distance from the center of the Earth, for example, to the satellite, right? The distance between their centers. So there we know how fast we would have to have an object going if I put it at a particular one at going around there at a particular distance, and we know what the mass of the center body is. It's independent of the little one. Of course, we could plug numbers in here. G is the usual 6.67 times 10 to the minus 11 in the appropriate units. Okay, so that's fairly simple. We just need to plug some numbers in. But we're about out of time for today, so we won't plug any numbers in yet. Okay, that's most of chapter 5. All right, tomorrow's quiz is the end of chapter 4, right, plus chapter 5.